What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
UBUR.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. The use of terror is nothing new. Since the beginning of time, rivals have used acts of terrorism against each other. But one medieval Persian group in particular was so expert at terror and stealth that their name has forever been linked with political murder. This hour, the story of the assassins. But first, caught by the Northern Alliance and then on videotape, the bizarre saga and legal battle of American Taliban fighter John Walker continues to unfold in Afghanistan. Kevin Fagan is covering the story for the San Francisco Chronicle. Earlier, I asked him about the latest developments and what he thinks Walker knows about the inner workings of the Taliban.
He must know something, having fought with the Taliban, evidently. The thing about this kid, or 20-year-old, is that we really don't know how much involvement he had in combat. I mean, he may have been one of their hardcore warriors, or he may have been dragged along with the tide. It's really unclear. But whatever he's saying, the officials are liking what he's saying over there. That's what we're hearing.
Kevin, take us back to the beginning of John Walker's long odyssey that ended up in Mazar-i Sharif. Where did he come from, and how did he get set on this path?
Well, he grew up in Maryland, Washington area, and came out here when he was about 10 to California. His dad's a lawyer. Dad got a pretty good job at a utility company out here. And made some pretty good money. The family wound up in Marin County, which is a pretty affluent suburb of San Francisco. Mm-hmm. You know, he began spiritually questing at a pretty young age, about 14, 15. He was wondering what he wanted to do with himself, and he decided at 16 he wanted to go into Islam. And so he joined a mosque in Mill Valley and very quickly got deeply into the religion, so much so that he wore only spiritually traditional clothes in his house, out shopping.
Do you know what first attracted John Walker to Islam?
He read the autobiography of Malcolm X at age 15, I believe it was.
Did he have a religious background with his family?
He was Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
His parents seemed like very nice folks. You know, they're not talking a whole lot, but just from what we've been able to see, they seemed to be fairly accepting of whatever intellectual questioning he wanted to do. And he told them he wanted to look into, you know, Islamic studies, and they said, fine. And the dad told me that Catholicism and Islam had enough, you know, commonalities that he was okay with that.
How did young John Walker first end up in Pakistan?
He wound up there after first going to Yemen mm-hmm. to study Arabic languages and the Quran. He figured he'd go over to the cradle of Islamic studies. And he spent a year or so over there, came back, and then quickly went back again, and then went from there, I believe, over to Pakistan, because Pakistan had a lot of religious schools that were pretty renowned as where if you want to go study the Quran, you go there.
Many of those schools are also renowned for being hotly anti-American. Did he get pulled into that vortex? Do we know?
That would be a guess, because there's a lot of recruitment out of those schools for soldiers for the Taliban.
Yeah. What do we know about how he ended up with the Taliban?
We don't. Even his parents don't know. He disappeared about 6-7 months ago, and the parents were wondering where the heck he was. They started passing out photos of the local mosques, wondering if any of his friends back here had heard anything of him. Mm-hmm. That's how worried they were. And then suddenly they flick on the TV about a week ago, and there he is on CNN, you know, with his arms tied behind him in some mud fort over in Afghanistan. It kind of blew their mind.
And ultimately being questioned by Mike Spann, the CIA agent slash commando who died only hours later, probably at his own gun and beaten by other Taliban prisoners. That little film clip looked like an incredible meeting of the Alabama boy Mike Spann and the California spiritual quester there, didn't it?
Yeah, who said nothing. He was trying to stay quiet, or if he'd already been beaten to a pulp. I don't know. It's hard to tell from looking at the video. I'd be very curious to find out.
Have his parents said anything since that came out or since his discovery and arrest?
Well, not since the video came out. During the first couple of days, Frank Lind, John's father, came out and talked to first only a couple of people, and then, you know, I talked to him early in the morning. And then as the day went on, the drumbeat just got so loud, he finally came out and gave a quick interview to the general press corps out here. But since then, you know, he did the round of some TV shows, and after that, he shut the door, and that was it. And all the comments now go through his lawyer.
Is it the case that his son, John Walker, may now be open to being tried for treason?
He could. It seems unlikely. That's a very hard case to prove. There's only been about 30 treason charges ever brought in the history of the United States. It looks pretty bad looking at the video and hearing what you've heard. But all the legal scholars we've talked to say, yeah, it's pretty unlikely. More likely what would happen would be they cut a deal or try him on some charge they can make stick. It's really murky territory right now until they get him back here and they find out exactly what happened and how.
So is it possible that he'll just be put on a plane and flown home to California and get a job?
His parents would like that. Their standpoint right now, what they're telling people, and I believe they're sincere when they're saying this, they think the kid got brainwashed over there somehow. And so they see it as a hardship case more than a case of someone who decided to take up arms and go kill Americans. I mean, there's a lot of sentiment out there that the kid is a traitor or whatever you want to call him. People start talking about sticking the guy up for treason charges or conspiracy charges. That is one that I've heard also. Hey, they don't know yet. The people we talked to over the weekend said that most likely he would cut a deal with whatever prosecutors he wound up running up against because he's given information, and that's valuable in a legal setting. I'd say the chances of him getting tried for treason are really small.
Kevin Fagan is a reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. He spoke to us from San Francisco. When he came home to Europe, Marco Polo brought fascinating stories of the Near and Far East. Among these was the tale of the charismatic leader Hassan al-Sabah and his cult of assassins. He told of great mountain warriors who drugged themselves to wreak havoc and terror, murdering enemy leaders for the promise of paradise in the afterlife. He told of their ability to blend into their enemies' cultures, speak their languages, dress in disguise, and learn their court etiquette to get at their leaders. Much of this was true. The assassins, or Hashishins, as they were called, were a group of extremists based in Persia that for 200 years successfully used acts of terror to strike fear in their enemies. Almost 1,000 years later, the story of the assassins evokes broad parallels with the 21st century's inaugural terrorist threat, Al-Qaeda. Tonight, we look back at the assassins in history and fable and consider their resonance today. Are Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda the new assassins, and are we doomed to repeat history? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined now by Farhad Daftari, the head of academic research and publications and a professor at the Institute of Ismaili Studies in London. Welcome, Dr. Farhad Daftari.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. And with us from Vermont is special coverage news analyst Jack Beattie. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Dr. Daftari, tell us if you would, because we've all heard the name, but few of us really know much of the history. Who were the assassins?
Well, the so-called assassins were actually a branch of Ismailis who were Shiite Muslims. And the name assassins was actually coined by the Crusaders in medieval times, and it's really a misnomer, which should really not be used anymore. Now, they of course had a very long and complex history, which can be traced back to the 8th century. Now, you see, a branch of this community was founded in Iran. And of course, the founder of this community in Iran was a missionary by the name of Hassan al-Sabah, who was a learned theologian as well as a philosopher.
And a rather charismatic leader.
Yes.
And this was Iran today, but Persia at that time. And we read that this sect withdrew and attacked from the mountains in Persia. What were they upset about? Why were they attacking?
Right. Well, this group had been actually...
Yes, Dr. Daftari.
Yes. Hello?
Yes, we're here.
Yes, the group had been persecuted for about 200 years by the Sunni Muslims, you see.
Right. This goes back to the initial conflicts within Islam about
right.
who were the proper heirs to Muhammad.
Right. And
so you had the Sunni Shiite split and the
Sunni, yes.
The so-called assassins were
belonged to the Shiite, you see, community.
And you said earlier that they came out of an Ismaili movement.
Yes.
What was that movement?
That was a subgroup of the Shiites. You see, the Shiites, you see, themselves over time split into various groups, and Ismailis actually comprised, one of the most significant groups within Shiite Islam.
And their goal was to overturn the Sunni caliphate. In other words, to overturn the Sunni leaders of Islam. Is that right?
That could have been, you see, a goal, but more immediately, they were actually concerned with their own survival, and once they came into the position of a state in Iran, they sort of based themselves in a number of mountain fortresses.
And how did they get their reputation over the next couple hundred years while they plagued their enemies? How did they get their reputation for stealth and for political murder?
Well, you see, assassinations were actually practiced before them, and they were also practiced at the same time by, most groups, you see, and rulers, including the Crusaders and the Seljuk, you see, Turks. The Seljuk, you see, Turks had, at that time, invaded Iran,
mm-hmm.
and they, of course, you see, belonged to the Sunni sort of branch, and you see, and their alien rule over Iran was strongly abhorred, you see, by Iranians.
So you describe it as then a kind of resistance effort.
Yes, yes, and of course Hassan drew on these, you see, feelings, you see, and sentiments, and at the same time, of course, he was also concerned with safeguarding, the well-being of his community, and he did not invent assassination, and he could not raise, large armies to combat, the Seljuk, Turks, and therefore he he, in the course of some 34 years of his rule, perhaps assassinated, no more than some 30 individuals.
And yet it created an enormous reputation for him and for his assassin warriors, if you will.
You see, the reason for that can be traced to the hostility of the Sunnis towards the Ismaili Shiites, and for that reason, every assassination of any significance which took place in the Islamic lands were attributed by the Sunnis to the so-called assassins.
Farhad Daftari, we're going to have to take a break in just a minute, but Jack Beatty, I want to bring you in here. Isn't it fascinating, Jack, wherever you stick a fork into history, it's more complex than you thought?
Yes, and it has echoes. I mean, here's a line from The Adventures of Marco Polo. And when the old man wished to kill someone, he would take him and say, "Go and do this thing. I do this because I want to make you return to paradise." and the assassins go and perform the deed willingly. Well, Hamas is doing precisely that in Gaza and the West Bank. They're the young men who suicide bombers are called martyrs. They're given this elaborate propaganda of the deed about paradise, and so it's the same sort of lore is still working its fatal effect.
We're talking tonight about the assassins. Obviously, there's a lot of legend and fable. There's also a rich history of fact. We're going to pick it apart tonight and see if there are parallels or if the resonance of the assassins' legacy is still at work today in Al-Qaeda. Will Al-Qaeda's story be told in legends a thousand years from now? And are we doomed to repeat history? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can get into the conversation online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. We'll be right back. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the history and fables of the assassins, the Persians, resistance fighters, as our first guest has described them, almost 1,000 years ago, who for 200 years plagued their enemies throughout the Middle East. They worked out of a mountain encampment or redoubt. They had a charismatic leader who founded the sect, and it all sounds astonishingly familiar today. We're looking at how close those parallels are and how much they matter. How much this history resonates in Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden's efforts today. What do you think? The assassins lingered 200 years. Will Al-Qaeda go faster? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined now by Bernard Lewis. He's Professor Emeritus of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University and author of The Assassins, as well as some remarkably insightful works since September 11th that have helped illuminate issues around Islam and their interaction with the West for all of us. Good evening, Bernard Lewis.
Evening.
Thanks for joining us. We're looking at the assassins tonight and partly just trying to become familiar with the history and what's history and what's fable. Walk us through some of that, if you would, of what's commonly known and understood about the assassin. What is factual history? And then what's the elaborated fable?
Well, we have quite a lot of information from different sources. The best information, of course, is that which comes from within the assassin camp, that is to say, from the Ismaili Muslims, and there's a certain amount of that. Then we have what non-Ismaili Muslims wrote about them at the time. And then we have some, on the whole, rather fantastic stuff from Western visitors, crusaders, travelers, and others. And from this variety of sources, one can, I think, put together a fairly detailed picture of who they were and what they were doing.
How would you describe them? And I hope in your description we'll see why their reputation survives to this day.
Well, they have been described as the first terrorists. That isn't exactly true. There were terrorists before them in ancient Greece and Rome and the Middle East. There were people who saw it as a sacred, one might even say as a religious duty, to remove some tyrant, and people who did that were fated as heroes. Mm-hmm. The assassins were probably the first to build it up into a system, an organization with an ideology and a long-term program. I suppose in that sense, you might say they were the first really organized, systematic terrorist group.
And did they use the promise of a marvelous paradise to bring their recruits into readiness to commit murders that might well end in their own death?
Well, there are stories to that effect, but these, I would say, are rather doubtful.
Mm-hmm.
There are stories, yes, but they're told from outside, and there's no real confirmation of this from internal evidence.
So what are some of the historically grounded stories of the kind of attacks that earned the assassins such a reputation?
Well, they were very skillful. They would prepare themselves for an attack, if necessary, over very long periods. They would learn languages. They would disguise themselves. They would infiltrate themselves into the enemy camp and wait for the moment and then seize it. But a point I would like to make, if I may,
please,
is some very essential differences between the medieval assassins and the terrorists of the present day who are considered to be their successors.
Lay those out for us.
Yes. Well, the first difference is they did not commit suicide. That is to say, they did not die by their own hand. They went knowingly to a certain death, attacking against impossible odds, seeking out their victim and killing him, and then making no attempt to escape. It was even considered to be disgraceful to escape or to survive, but they did not die by their own hand.
Would you then make a distinction between their approach and, let's say, a suicide bomber?
Well, from the point of view of Muslim law and tradition, there's a very important difference. The traditional Islamic view is that suicide is a mortal sin. Dying in battle against impossible odds is a great virtue and qualifies for eternal bliss. But dying by your own hand is suicide, and it earns eternal damnation. Punishment in hell to consist of the endless repetition of the act of suicide. The idea that killing yourself along with others is, so to speak, acceptable is a very modern one. It dates from the 20th century, and it has no foundation in earlier Islamic teachings. The other difference,
yes,
which I think is extremely important, is that their attacks were always on an individual. They had designated targets. They were usually people of some eminence. It might be a ruler, a minister, a military commander, some religious dignitary seen as hostile. They would somehow manage to infiltrate themselves into the immediate surrounding of these people, who were, of course, very closely guarded. And then at the chosen moment, they would strike. There was no what people nowadays call collateral damage. No one else was injured at all in the strikes of the medieval assassins. Only the intended victim.
Bernard Lewis, I want to bring Jack Beattie into the conversation. Jack, given the kind of history that Bernard Lewis is describing here, do you see resonance in the al-Qaeda movement today? Not necessarily factual. He's drawing very interesting and important distinctions here, but cultural resonance? Perhaps we should put the question to him. But
yeah. Well, what strikes me, just as he tells the story, is this way that these people can live in apart and sort of ostensible lives in foreign places and hold discipline against all the suasions to which they're subjected, against education, against affinities of romance, against economic ambition, can hold their discipline in this state of sort of ideological totalism, and then when the moment is right to act. And the recruitment of such people, Muhammad Atta being our version of it, of that sort of monster, is an extraordinary action. And the person, the old man, for the assassins or whoever it is that recruits people for al-Qaeda, has really found people who are very rare. I mean, even in studies of combat have shown that many soldiers don't even shoot to kill, that the desire to kill is the ability to do it is or capacity to do it is very rare. And to find these people, to recruit them, to set them among us, there's an extraordinarily skillful recruiter out there who fits in line with this storied group, it seems to me.
Bernard Lewis, what about that? As a historian, can you draw a line down across the centuries that connects the assassins' ability to recruit and prepare and train their killers and the ability of al-Qaeda to do that today? Is there a connection?
I don't see a historical connection. For one thing, the assassins were a sect of Islam. They were Ismaili Shia. That is to say, from the point of view of a Sunni Muslim, which is what al-Qaeda are,
yes,
they were, so to speak, a heresy of a heresy.
Meaning that they were
Shia,
not only
but
not...
But a dissident group of Shia.
And
there's no connection. Now, the second thing is that the assassin movement died out in the 13th century. Their followers remained, but they are peaceful people living in villages and small towns in Syria, in Iran, in parts of Central Asia, and above all, in India and Pakistan. I know of no historical connection. They did read about them, of course. They read about them in history books.
I guess that's what I mean to say. Perhaps historical connection is the wrong word, but a cultural connection. Are the assassins the subject of legends and fables passed down within Middle Eastern culture today?
No, I would say revived. They attracted much more attention in the West than in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of what was said about them was stories, often usually rather wild stories, brought back by the Crusaders and then developed by mostly European scholars. I mean, the modern discussion of the assassins in the Middle East really begins with translations from Western books. Then, of course, they adopted it. It's interesting. I mean, the assassin was not a term that they used of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They called themselves fidai, the faithful ones. And this term was revived in the 19th century and used by various dissident groups, and more recently by some of these groups of which you're speaking at the present time.
So, ironically, it seems as though you're describing their reputation down through the centuries as created in large part by fabulists from the West, maybe even with a kind of racist undertone, or maybe definitely.
No, I wouldn't go that far.
No, all right. But then brought back into the culture out of Western literature and embraced in some quarters by the groups that may have some lineage to Al-Qaeda.
Yes, that is possible. But as I tried to say before, their methods are very different. The medieval assassins targeted a single individual, an individual of importance whose removal was seen as necessary for their cause. They did not attack anyone else. There was no what people nowadays call collateral damage. Another point is that they always used the same weapon, the dagger. They never used missiles of any kind. I mean, they could have used arrows, or they could have used bows and arrows or crossbows or catapults. There are a number of missile weapons available in medieval warfare.
Mm-hmm.
They could have used poison. They never did.
The dagger required a kind of courage and audacity and a warrior.
Mm-hmm. To use the dagger, you had to penetrate through all the guards and other barriers. You had to get right up to the victim in person. And, of course, you had no chance at all of escape.
Bernard Lewis, hold on. We have callers who want to join this conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the history and legends of the assassins. Ahmed is on the line. Welcome, Ahmed. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I'd like to make a clear point here. I'm a Sunni Muslim, and I'd like to make it clear to the listeners and to everybody who doesn't know about the difference between Muslim and Shia.
Mm-hmm.
Sunni is the people who are originally established, I mean, like, originally the followers of the Prophet, peace be upon him. The Shia, they came in after the death of the Prophet, where there was a problem between the what we call them the Khalifa, the leaders. They came in after the Prophet. There was Ali, and Ali is the cousin of the Prophet. He is the fourth Khalifa, and there is this group that they call themselves Shia. They establish a problem. They cause a problem between Ali and the Khalifa before him.
And then Bernard Lewis is telling us that the assassins came from even a subsect, the Ismailis.
Yeah. Then Ali himself, he fought this group who called they are loyal to him. They call themselves loyal to him. He fought them and he killed them, and he refused their loyalty because They want to generate a new cult in Islam that's associated with Islam, which is not absolutely.
So we got now, the history, but what's your point, Ahmed? That they're not Muslims?
The point is, it is not fair to call those assassins. I mean, to compare them with, for example, I'm talking about the freedom fighters in the Muslim world. I'm talking about the Hamas and the others. I'm not talking about the Qaeda now. Just to be specific,
because all right.
If Osama bin Laden and his followers, the Qaeda, did what they did in New York, which is not unacceptable Islamically, which is we all know that.
Mm-hmm.
But we were talking about the freedom fighters. When your guest he compared them with Hamas and Jihad,
mm-hmm.
those people they are freedom fighters. That's what's been known as the freedom fighter until recently.
Ahmed, let me ask you, do you accept that the assassins were, in fact, Muslims?
No, they were not. The Ismailis, actually, they are not Muslims. they're not considered to be Muslim, because there's a basic rule in Islam. Anyone change basic thing in Islam that's from the Quran or the Sunnah, anyone who change, make changes, basic changes, is not considered to be Muslim. I give an example.
Ahmed, we've got your perspective. I want to put it to Professor Farhad Daftari in London. Professor, do you agree that the Ismailis, the assassins, were not Muslims, as our caller Ahmed asserts?
No, not at all. I mean, in fact, from the very beginning, the Ismailis were always considered as a Shiite community, and this is how they are conceived today. Now, perhaps in some countries like Saudi Arabia, and perhaps in parts of Pakistan, and perhaps by the Taliban, they may not be considered as Muslims. In fact, some of these countries look down on the Shias, and the Shias were actually massacred in Afghanistan by the Taliban. So, I mean, but the fact of the matter is that the Ismailis have and were always considered as Shiite
Muslims. And Bernard Lewis, what do you hear in Ahmed's disowning of the Shiite Ismailis?
Well, it would be an impertinence for a non-Muslim like myself to say who are good Muslims and who aren't.
But Ahmed is saying they're not Muslims at all. All right.
And that is, among Muslims as among Christians, there have been major differences. There were times in Christian history when Protestants and Catholics would have said of each other they are not real Christians. Nevertheless, historically, one must regard them, I think, as different forms of the same Christian faith. And I would say the same is true historically of Islam. There have been Sunni and Shia in Islam since a very early date. And among the Shia, there have been a number of further subdivisions, one of which is the Ismailis. The Ismailis, as I said before, they are, from a Sunni point of view, a heresy of a heresy. But the Islamic tradition doesn't exclude those who believe differently. It only excludes those who are unbelievers. If one pretends to be a Muslim but is not, then one is an apostate, and that is a much more serious matter. And the great theologians of Islam advise to use this very sparingly.
Jack Beatty, Ahmed's call reminds us of again, of the complexity here, and particularly his desire to separate even the memory, the legacy of the assassins from Hamas.
Yes, and I was interested in what Bernard Lewis said about suicide and its doctrinal it's the scorn that the essential Islamic doctrine has for it. I don't see in that respect how the people of Hamas can justify themselves as religious martyrs if to commit suicide is anathema in Islam. How does that work, Professor? Is this some sort of
Bernard Lewis, we're coming up, I'm afraid, on a break. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to ask you just to hold that answer for a moment. We've got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. We're talking about the assassins, the long history, the fable, the legend, with Bernard Lewis, Professor Emeritus of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University and author of The Assassins, and with Professor Farhad Daftari, Head of Academic Research and Publishing and Professor of the Institute of Ismaili Studies in London, author of Assassin Legends. You can join the conversation. We'll be back after a quick break. Do we ever escape the models and resonance of history? Are the assassins and their fables still at work in the history we're living through right now? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about fact, fiction, and the Persian sect of the assassins and their resonance today. Which do you fear more, uniformed militaries or the stealthy assassin? are Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda the new assassins? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Professor Bernard Lewis, Jackpedia just put the question before the break about Hamas and the place of suicide in Islamic resistance movements. Where would you place Hamas?
Oh, I see no direct historical link between Hamas and similar movements at the present time and the medieval assassins. They came from very different branches of Islam. They had very different methods and very different ideologies. I don't see any connection there. And in particular, on the point of suicide, according to Islamic teachings, suicide is a mortal sin. And there is a world of difference between risking or accepting certain death in battle at the hands of an overwhelmingly stronger enemy and dying by your own hand. And this is amply documented in Muslim traditions.
There are a lot of callers who would like to join us. Let's go there. Sarah's on the line. Welcome, Sarah. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'd like to suggest that by looking at the assassins through the paradigm of Hamas or al-Qaeda, we are, in fact, making a mistake. Perhaps it would be more accurate to draw a comparison with them to, say, political assassinations, for example, Israel's current policy, because, as Professor Lewis has suggested, these assassinations were very, you know, particularly targeted without any collateral damage, which does seem to me more like a state assassination policy.
Our callers always provoke us to think. Bernard Lewis, what about that parallel? Is it closer than the parallel to Hamas or al-Qaeda?
Well, it's closer in one respect, and that is that it was aimed at an individual and not the random slaughter of anyone who happened to be in the neighborhood. But it's certainly not state-sponsored.
That
of the medieval assassins.
Well, did they qualify as a state? They lasted for a long time.
Good point. I mean, they did have their strongholds. They had their bases, not only in Persia, but also in Syria. That is one curious resemblance of the present-day and medieval assassination movements. They have the same bases, one in Iran and one in Syria. And in that respect, yes, they had these inaccessible mountain strongholds where they trained and prepared their expeditions and then sent them out.
And when the story or the understanding of the assassins was translated to Europe through the Crusaders, how was it typically or specifically embroidered, Bernard Lewis?
The Crusaders made, first of all, a mistake in thinking that this movement was directed against them. It wasn't. It was directed principally against the rulers of the Islamic world. The assassin movement was what we would nowadays call a revolutionary movement. They had an ideology and a program. Their ideology was that the existing government and rulers of the Islamic world were sinful and were false Muslims, and their ideology was to replace them by what they regarded as the true and authentic Islam.
This sounds very familiar.
To be led by the true and authentic leader.
And how were they ultimately wiped out, or were they?
In the long run, they failed. They assassinated a number of people without effecting any radical change. And then finally, they were destroyed in Syria by the Sultan of Egypt and in Persia by the Mongols. Their castles were captured. Their bases were destroyed. They lived on, but as peaceful rural populations. They're still there.
Still there even today. We're at 1-800. We're at 1-800-423-8255. The assassins lingered for 200 years and then more. Do you think al-Qaeda will go faster? Or is there any comparison to be drawn? Ram is on the line. Welcome, Ram. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, this is Ram from Boston.
Welcome.
Yes, I tend to agree with Dr. Bernard Lewis and a couple of your other listeners. It seems to me that this trying to link between the assassins, or at least a cultural link between the assassins and the al-Qaeda, is tenuous as best. The methodologies and their ideologies are entirely different. And the fact that a group could collect and recruit individuals to strongly believe in a certain ideology is across the board. If you take the IRA, for example, or the Liberation Tigers of Sri Lanka, there is no link there to assassins or to Islam, for example.
Ram, you make a strong point that this is hardly the only example of groups in history and around the world who have recruited terrorists who were willing to go to extraordinary lengths and put themselves at risk. But Bernard Lewis, what about the recruitment and the training of assassins? From Marco Polo, a famously embroidered teller of history sometimes, as Jack Beattie read earlier in the hour, the description of how recruits were trained and seduced or led to their very dangerous missions sounds a lot like what we heard in the notes and diaries of the terrorists on September 11th. Are there any parallels there?
Well, there are these stories which are told by Marco Polo and other Western visitors. But I must say I have found no reliable evidence in Middle Eastern sources whether Ismaili or anti-Ismaili supporting this.
And Farhad Daftari, do you see anything in the methods of recruitment or the ideology around preparing killers for murder that would include their own death that would link the assassins and present-day al-Qaeda?
No, I wouldn't actually see any. I mean, I wouldn't draw any similarities you see between the two. In fact, most of what has been reported about the practices of the Ismailis is found really in the Western sources, and that basically is a sort of misrepresentation of the teachings and the practices of the Ismailis. And these were actually, you see, the myths and legends, which in fact were fabricated by the Crusaders and their Western historians over a period of almost 200 years, and they finally found the culmination in a synthesis produced by Marco Polo, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't really sort of attribute any sort of any reliability to these accounts, because the Sunni Muslim sources, even though you see they were extremely hostile towards just Ismailis, do not, in fact, repeat these sort of fixes.
And you suggest that they surely would have if they thought there was grounds for it.
Surely, yes.
Professor Farhad Daftari, we thank you for joining us tonight.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Farhad Daftari is head of academic research and publishing and a professor at the Institute of Ismaili Studies in London. Bernard Lewis, we just have another second, but you did say earlier that these stories, which were embroidered by the West, did come back into the political mind of the Middle East in this century.
They came back in modern times through Arabic and Persian translations of Western books. And
do you imagine Osama bin Laden has read those?
I have no idea what he has read. But certainly these, from the early 19th century, the first modern books about the assassins, I mean, what you might call scholarly books, were written in Europe in the early 19th century. And these became known, and virtually everything else that was written in Europe became known. My little book on the assassins has been translated no less than 3 times into Arabic.
So someone's reading that.
Alas, yes.
Bernard Lewis, thanks so much for joining us tonight. Bernard Lewis is Professor Emeritus of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University and author of The Assassins. Jack Beattie, we've run our time almost down, but thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
You can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Tonight, Jews around the world light the menorah for the second night of Hanukkah. This festival of lights is a time for celebration and reflection. David Gaffney is rabbi at the conservative synagogue of Fifth Avenue in New York City, located just blocks from the Twin Towers. We asked him to share his thoughts on the meaning of Hanukkah in these uncertain times.
The story of Hanukkah is a story of the valiant efforts of a small group to defend themselves against tyranny and to create an environment of liberty and freedom, religious freedom and national freedom. After the temple was polluted and after the people of Israel had been tyrannized for years, not allowing any religious freedom and religious liberty, Mattathias and his sons, the Maccabees, fought against the Syrian Greeks, rededicated the temple, and won the day for religious freedom against tyranny. The story of the celebration of Hanukkah is a story of multiculturalism. When evil raises its ugly head, when tyranny attempts to stamp out the nuances of differences between religious faiths and between ethnic communities, the story of Hanukkah is really a story which expresses the beauty of each individual group. Tyranny tries to homogenize us, make us one so that we can be controlled. The story of Hanukkah is a story which celebrates our differences so that each of us can live out our own ideals and our own values and our own cultural forms, and is very much a multicultural expression. What the candles are supposed to kindle inside of us is really a sense of faith against darkness, the power of light, the power of sharing the flame of freedom and liberty between members of a community. It suggests that evil can be vanquished. If evil is darkness, then the taper of each candle, the light that it represents, is our ability to conquer darkness and bring light to mankind in its quest for liberty and freedom. The Conservative Synagogue of Fifth Avenue on 11th Street is just a mile or two away from Ground Zero. We, for weeks, walked with masks on our faces. And I was personally able to counsel many individuals. There was one young woman in particular whose fiancé was worked for Cantor Fitzgerald, and who especially needed my help because her fiancé and their plans for marriage had suddenly gone up in smoke, and she felt terrible, and we tried to comfort her. So we were very immediately affected in terms of our neighborhood and in terms of the many who lived in the community who came for refuge to this community at that time. The events of September 11th create an interesting coloration for the entire story of Hanukkah. If the events of September 11th represent evil and tyranny, the lights of the Hanukkah menorah, the determination of the people to remain free and to assure themselves freedom in the face of that evil, is terribly evocative. It suggests that each of us can light a candle and suggests that the flame of faith and community and love that is shared from wick to wick in each candle will ultimately vanquish even the contemporary forms of evil. The gift that I'd like to give to America is really America's gift to the entire world. I think it's clear that were it not for the events of Hanukkah more than 2,000 years ago, some of the other faiths that are the daughter faiths of Judaism, certainly Christianity and certainly Islam, would never have come to the forefront. So our gift, the gift of the Jewish people, was the gift of liberty and freedom and religious tolerance and religious independence. And America represents that most to the entire world. And so the story of Hanukkah and the celebration of Hanukkah really so coincides with what America is all about. And the symbol of that lady with her torch raised high is so significant because it can be perceived as one of the eternal lights of the Hanukkah candle, shining with its glowing light for liberty for all of mankind.
David Gaffney is rabbi at the Conservative Synagogue of Fifth Avenue in New York. Listeners, we want to know what music you've turned to since September 11th. Where are you turning for strength, for hope, or to grieve musically? Let us know. Email us at special@wbur.org. It's for a future show, so make sure to include your email address in case we need to contact you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR, Boston.